They're betting on countries going bust, on companies going bust. They're betting on everything. I don't understand why the financial system and the banks are not under the casino laws. Because where is the difference between betting on a horse and betting on an interest rate? There is no difference. You're betting.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Trump says threats to impeach him are energising him and he comes out fighting, asking the Chinese to dig up dirt on Joe Biden. As well as the Ukrainians. So we hear from the horse's mouth the history of the CIA whistleblower and how the transcript was published. Plus the film out this month about local Lass's role at the GCHQ trying to prevent the illegal Iraq war, called Official Secrets. GCHQ, of course, from Cheltenham. And hidden links only now coming to light about child sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. The links he had with the US tech giants. Was it blackmailing them that got him killed in his New York jail cell? Oh, sorry, it was suicide. And if not, what did? In our Super Brains series, we hear from Anton Chaitkin. He's the son of Jacob Chaitkin, who was the lawyer for the Jewish Boycott Committee of Nazi Germany in the United States. Super brain indeed. It's about the hit opening of Black History Month. It's him speaking about the black legend, the idea that we can return to a golden age by reversing the cultural changes brought about by colonisation. Sister show Dialect is here on BCFM Tuesday at noon this week. Former punk rock guitarist James Adlington and founder of Bristol Blue Glass in the late 1980s. He talks about how Virgin Records managed to spit him out even before he signed with them. Tells more musical tales of the 70s and beyond. Plus, Mike Sparks is back to look at Wild Bill Donovan, the man who collaborated with Ian Fleming to found the predecessor of the CIA, the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS. That's former US Marine and author Mike Sparks, who runs James Bond Is For Real website. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download that show right now from dialectradio.co.uk. But Martin, the main story this week has been the bubbling away of this impeachment of proceedings against Trump. What are your thoughts about whether that's going to fly or not?
Well, I think it's quite extraordinary, really, because it's pretty clear that Biden and Biden's son were heavily involved in corruption in the Ukraine. And, of course, what's really unfortunate for Zelensky is that his boss, Kolomoisky, who is the big oligarch behind Zelensky, he was also involved in Burisma Holdings with Biden's son. So it makes Zelensky, that's why Zelensky was looking so glum when Trump was pontificating about it at the UN, because whatever he does now, he's in trouble, because Trump's not happy with him because he hasn't kind of pursued this investigation. Biden got the previous investigator sacked, Biden Senior, and he even boasted about it, that he got him sacked. And of course, the underlying all of this is the corrupt privatisation of the new regime in Kiev. And that's that would be Kolomoisky, who was the other major shareholder, as far as I can see. There's a very good Eric Zeus article about all of this. And of course, it's all.
Whereabouts is Eric Zeus right?
Eric Zeus's article. It said EUSSE. I think I saw it. Ooh, I'll have to think.
I'll tell you what, we'll put a link up on the show page.
Yeah. But that's a very detailed analysis.
At thisweek.org.uk.
It's a very detailed analysis of the real shenanigans going on here. Of course, Zelensky's main financial backer and basically his puppet master is Kolomoisky.
So are these just enchanted oligarchs from the former Soviet Union?
They're all from the former Soviet Union because Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union. But these are the modern oligarchs in charge of anti-Russian Ukraine who were born in the Soviet Union, but it doesn't make much difference there. And of course, both Zelensky and Kolomoisky are Jewish Ukrainians.
One of the fascinating things that this whole business brings up is the role of state prosecutors. We're going to hear in a little while from Malaysia and the death, a strange death, assassination almost certainly of the Malaysian state prosecutor. Yeah. This case is really hinges on whether a state prosecutor is actually going to enforce the law or not. And it seems that one of the main ways the mafia around the world or organised crime operate in all sorts of different guises of organised crime is they make sure that state prosecutors only prosecute those who the president or the senior politicians say they want to prosecute.
Well, of course, organised crime wants to control the justice system. I mean, in Posimato, the guy that wrote La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni about NATO terrorism in Italy, who was the head of the Supreme Court, his brother was assassinated by the mafia. And basically, if prosecutors are worth their salt, they've got to take risks, and they're probably going to make themselves targets.
But, I mean, Donald Trump himself has been involved with the mob
Donald Trump,
over the years.
Trump said the mafia are really nice guys, you just don't want to owe them money. That's
like
what he said. Like he did, of course.
Yeah, it was. How did
you
know
they're
nice guys then? Well, because they had an agenda.
Well, that's right. I mean, his history. You see, the problem is it's pot kettle black. Most of these mainstream politicians in the US and Ukraine are absolutely corrupt. And they all are. So it's pretty easy. I mean, what happened in Russia when Putin, as it were, cleaned up the situation was he basically knew everybody was on the take. And so those who did as they were told were, led off with a slap on the wrist, and those who didn't do as they were told were sent
to
prison.
I thought it was pretty enlightening the other day to hear Trump give his side of what this conversation and how he actually arranged for the transcript of it to be released to the public, the conversation.
Well, he released the transcript after they bullied him about it, but he said, OK, here it goes, and listen to
that. And he said, well, there's nothing much to see here, so why shouldn't we release it? But, of course, he had to go through all sorts of things to do that. But anyway, here's the US President Donald Trump talking about... I mean, it's the fascinating thing about him, Martin, before we hear this, is that he said, this has really energised me. You know, I'm getting a tremendous amount of energy, and I think that this is going to be a positive thing for me in next year's presidential election.
Well, I think the Democrats are very unwise to spring to the defence of Joe Biden and Hunter Biden because they're basically corrupt. And, of course, what it is, it's the right wing of the Democratic Party trying to stitch up the nomination for what Wall Street wants. Tulsi Gabbard hasn't been allowed to speak on any of the TV debates, and they don't want Elizabeth Warren because they think she's...
It sounds like a stitch-up.
It is a stitch-up. Okay. Everything in the US is a stitch-up, and it's even more of a stitch-up in the Ukraine. That's the real world.
Well, let's have a listen now
it?
To Trump and his thoughts on the attempts to impeach him.
The president of Ukraine at the United Nations the other day, and previous to that, he announced through his spokesperson... said there was absolutely no pressure put on him. There was no quid pro quo at all. And if you look at this whistleblowers, which I have a lot of respect for whistleblowers, but only when they're real, his report of the phone call was totally different than the fact. But what got them was they never thought I was going to release the call, because I don't like doing that. I don't want to do it. I hope I don't have to do it again. Release phone calls to foreign dignitaries, to foreign leaders. I don't want to do that, John. I don't want to do it again. But I did it with the permission of the Ukrainian government. We got permission. We called up their representatives and asked them, would it be okay? Otherwise, I couldn't have done it. And if I wouldn't have done it, I would have been exposed to a lie. Because the whistleblower report... Didn't he say 7 or 8 times I said quid pro quo? In other words, you're going to do this or you're not going to get money. Now, in all fairness, Biden said it, and he's on tape. In all fairness, you have at least 4 United States senators, Democrats, that said it, and they said it a lot stronger than even Schiff and his made-up story said it. Obama, when he was dealing with the president of Russia... Not Putin. He said, hey, tell Vladimir I can do a lot more after the election. You remember that? You didn't make a big deal out of that. Everybody thought, oh, isn't that cute? Isn't that cute? My talk and my response, Lindsey Graham said, I never knew you were that nice. I can't believe you were that nice. He said that loud and clear. It was perfect. It was perfect. Not a thing wrong with it. To impeach a president over a fraud that was committed by other people that want to win an election in 2020, which they won't, is incredible. This is the greatest hoax. Now, it's gone on for a long time. We had the Mueller collusion delusion. Okay, that went on for years. And that's finally done. No collusion, no obstruction, no nothing. It was a joke. And everyone knows it. And it was from the day one. Now, I get 3 days of peace. And I'm walking into the United Nations, going to meet with the biggest leaders in the world. And I hear about the word impeachment. I said, what did I do now? And it was about a beautiful conversation that I had. And just remember this. The Ukrainian new president, a fine man, said, I don't know what you're talking about. There was no pressure. And he said it a number of times.
So Martin News is the Trump version, but I mean, he's going to have to stand the test of the House of Representatives potentially impeaching him.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of this stuff about Trump's Russia collusion, and they're trying to find anything on him. In actual fact, there's loads of real dirt on Trump because of his links to the mafia when he was up and coming. He went bankrupt several times and they bailed him out. He's got links to Epstein as well, of course. But the problem for the Democrats with all of that is they've all got links to the mafia and Epstein as well, so they can't accuse him of that. Basically, they're all corrupt, and it's very unedifying to watch them throwing mud at each other. But of course, ultimately, that people get the message that all of these people are corrupt. That's
well,
what people
I mean,
realize.
If you're around on Tuesday, around about 12:45 on Dialect, you'll hear Mike Sparks' take on that. He's a former U.S. Marine Corps officer and a novelist, writer. He's basically saying, well, this guy from the CIA who was listening in on this should never have spoken about it anywhere else. That's part of his job in the Secret Service, is not to go blabbing his mouth around.
Yeah, but the CIA, elements within the CIA don't like Trump because they don't trust him to go to war with Russia and all the rest of it. Other elements, you know, there are splits in the ruling class, which is why we're getting all this juicy dirt being thrown around the place.
I mean, how reliable is... I mean, the CIA is sort of a bit of an overmighty subject. That's where they go to thrive, and they seem to do quite well there. What is the CIA?
Well, it was set up out of the Office of Special Service,
Strategic Services
by Donovan and others at the end of World War II.
Well, it was Dulles Brothers, actually. Donovan was elbowed out and Dulles came in.
The point is that we've now got, in this country, intelligence services are far too powerful, and they're far too powerful in the United States. I'll tell you where they're less powerful, actually, is in Russia, because they've changed the setup. And because they've got experience of overmighty intelligence services, the politicians have pretty much got them where they want them.
Well, also,
whereas in the West, it's completely the other way around.
Okay,
we've got the delusion of democracy and the reality that this is actually a totalitarian setup.
Putting corrupt people in line is something that's definitely been going on over in Malaysia with the this report from the BBC World Service earlier this week. A guy called Tom Wright has written a book about the 1MDB scandal, and this is with these two characters, Joe Lowe and the former Prime Minister Najib Razak, who have now led to, I mean, basically the 1MDB was an investment bank which got set up, and the Prime Minister allegedly took millions of pounds out of it, put it straight into his personal bank account, and it was used to make Hollywood films, anything they wanted to, but it wasn't being used for the investment it was supposed to be for. And there was an enormous amount of fraud involving something like 15 Goldman Sachs bankers, and there's now warrants out for their arrest by the Malaysians. So it's interesting, isn't it? And the whole thing hinges again around the state prosecutor. In this case, as you'll hear from Tom Wright, the assassination of the state prosecutor in Malaysia, Kevin Moraes.
Well, you're referring to the public prosecutor in Malaysia who was involved in the drafting of the arrest warrant for former Prime Minister Najib Razak. This story is really about one of the largest ever financial heists. $4 to $5 billion, maybe even more, was stolen from the Malaysian Treasury. And Najib Razak, the then Prime Minister, oversaw this fraud. And he himself took $680 million into his personal bank account. a very complex tale, but the long and the short of it is that some people in the Malaysian government found out about it, and they started to, the Attorney General at the time, started to draw up documents in an attempt to arrest and prosecute Najib Razak. Najib Razak got wind of that. He fired his Attorney General. He shut down a newspaper. He took a bunch of, and Malaysia is a nominal democracy, took a bunch of steps that turned Malaysia towards sort of autocracy. And then this prosecutor who'd been involved in drafting up the arrest warrant for Najib Razak, a draft arrest warrant, was found dead in a barrel in Kuala Lumpur. And the story is that he was killed for another reason, some other corruption scandal that he was investigating. But the fear is that he was somehow killed because of his involvement with that draft arrest warrant for Najib Razak. And that it really has not been solved yet. And for us in writing Billion Dollar Whale, that was really one of the key moments when Najib Razak and his people around him tried to stop the truth getting out about what had happened.
This huge amount of money came from people who thought, some people anyway, who thought they were investing in something real.
Yes. I mean, so how the scam worked, Malaysia set up a sovereign wealth fund, a fund to manage money of the country and to invest for the people of Malaysia to improve its economy. A young Malaysian called Jolo, who was 28 years at the time and had the ear of Najib Razak, the prime minister, and Najib Razak sort of covered for him and allowed him to run this fund from behind the scenes. The fund was called 1MDB. And they simply stole the money. And the way they stole it was they pretended to do investments with other funds in other countries in the Middle East. And they didn't do anything. They were supposed to create a new financial center in Kuala Lumpur. They were supposed to build green energy businesses, but they didn't do anything. They just took the money. So the money was used by Jolo to fund a Hollywood entertainment industry. And Najib used his share to sort of buy off politicians and voters in Malaysia.
And it worked.
Well,
it worked. To begin with.
It worked to begin with. Eventually, the whole house of cards came crashing down. In last year during elections, Najib lost the election, and mainly because of all the details of this started coming out, you know, in our book and in other places. And he's now facing trial in Malaysia.
Bank compliance officers started to notice that this was a very strange path for money to be taking back, 2009? So why didn't that stop these activities?
So what Billion Dollar Whale shows is that the compliance functions in banks and the auditors and all these institutions that are supposed to stop fraud in the capitalist system don't work. And the reason they don't work is because it's in no one's interests to stop big flows of money when that's where your salary is coming from, right? The way Jolo got away with this, he would move hundreds of millions of dollars around and he would argue to the compliance people, this is government-to-government business, so you don't need to worry about it. Like, we have the Malaysian Prime Minister, this is a state fund in Malaysia, we're dealing with state funds in the Middle East. And he always would call this government-to-government business. And and frankly, I think that a lot of people that dealt with him, a lot of financial institutions that helped move the money, they knew that it was shady. Right, they made so much money from this. The bankers involved in it made their careers, and that's that time and again. That's what Jolo preys on. He knows that's how he figures out how the world really works, and he uses that to bamboozle compliance and bamboozle people.
Is Jolo a clever man? I mean, here he came from college. He was just out of college, and he got involved in this amazing billion-dollar enterprise. It means there's some skills there, whether they're creditable or not.
Well, we tried to make it. We didn't want to make the book preachy. He's an extremely skillful person. He will go down in history as the one of the preeminent fraudsters of our time. His great skill was networking. He wanted to meet powerful people.
Well, he organized great parties.
He got to know the Sultan of Brunei's family when he was at Harrow, and he would go to China White, the nightclub that used to be popular in London, and he would book tables under the name of the Brunei royal family, even though he was, they didn't know anything about that. He would organize parties at Wharton where he didn't pay the tab. He'd pay for everyone, $40,000 and then not pay the bar tab. And he was building up a reputation from the very start for being richer than he was.
Where is he now?
So since the news about Jolo broke 4 years ago, and Najib was still in power at that time, Najib denied everything and he told Jolo to leave Malaysia. It was too sort of hot for him to live there. So he went to China. And Jolo has been charged in the US and in Malaysia. There's an ongoing criminal case against Jolo in the US. But Jolo will not come to face trial in the US. He says he will not get a fair trial. But has not explained why. And Jolo still has yet to come and face or answer questions about, you know, what he's done.
Well, this is an enormous financial scandal. As I said, 15 Goldman Sachs bankers warrants out for their arrest. Martin, how come this sort of thing won't happen in London?
Well, I mean, it's all linked. You can bet.
Well, I'm talking about the arrests, not the fraud.
No, exactly. I mean, this is the tip of an iceberg, which is, even, you know, enormous. And of course, there are geopolitical implications for all of this. Malaysia is regarded as a non-reliable country by the Western alliance because of its
rule of law.
Sorry,
because it's got a rule of law.
Well, you could argue that that's part of it. Yes, I mean, but Mahathir Mohamad, who's now back in charge, he's an old guy now, he's in his 90s. Questioned 9/11 and said, well, we don't believe the story you're telling us here. And the other thing that they did in 1998, when there was basically an engineered crisis in Southeast Asia by the by Wall Street and the City of London, they brought in exchange controls, which of course exchange controls were just normal practice for many decades after World War II.
But Joe Lowe was straight out of college. He's asking the question there, was he the mastermind? Clearly he wasn't. The actual international bankers, the banksters, the Goldman Sachs people, probably just offered him a job, but knowing that he would keep his mouth shut.
Yeah, but what you want is young gophers like that who do it all, and then of course if anybody takes the rap, then it's them. But of course, underlying all of this is the fact that fraud has become the normal way in which financial markets operate. And basically, we bailed out fraudsters in 2008, and far from being punished, it's basically a win-win for them. They steal and steal and steal, and when everything goes down the drain, the government pony up to bail it all out, and they carry on as before.
Ultimately, that's not going to carry on. People may well have seen the film The Wolves of Wall Street. This is financed from the fraud here. The Wolves of Wall Street, the feature film.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't be surprising, would it? I mean, basically, the drug cartels bailed out the banking system in 2008, and everybody pontificates about we're going to do something like county lines, drug gangs and all the rest of it. But the banking system's based on the drugs industry. That's what keeps it going. It had all collapsed years ago if money laundering wasn't going on. And this is the reality of what's happened. We need to nationalise the banking system and run it as a public utility, but that won't happen until we've gone through another horrendous crash, I'm afraid.
Well, some of the latest on 1MDB scandal is that the Malaysian authorities say they know where wanted 1MDB financier Joe Lowe is. What we were hearing there was potentially being hidden in China. Is that just a smear, do you think?
I've no idea. It may or may not be so. But as you say, what often happens in these situations is somebody has turned out to be, oh, that's the bad guy, he's in China or whatever it is. But it's systemic anyway. Yeah. It's a systemic problem. It's not just a few bad apples. The reality is that if you don't carry out fraudulent activity, then your competitors will, and you will go out of business.
One of the things that 1MDB apparently was designed to do was to protect Najib Razak from prosecution, the idea being that there's a massive fund there to fund all sorts of different methods, some criminal, some potentially murderous even, in order to make sure that the fund and the Prime Minister were all protected with this money.
Yes, and that particular Prime Minister...
The ex-chief executive of that state fund, 1MDB, has just said that in court this week.
Yeah, but don't forget that they were being protected also because that government in Malaysia was much more acceptable to the Western powers than the Mahathir Mohamad government, which had preceded it. Similarly, like attacks in Shinawatra and his sisters and other hangers-on in Thailand are the darlings of Wall Street.
I have to apologise for last week's show because the servers didn't record it just an hour before our programme started. Apparently there was a power cut here in the Eastern Community Centre, and then just about an hour after we'd finished, someone managed to restart the server which records the programme. So there was no programme. On the off chance that anybody out there was recording last week's show, very much appreciate a copy of it. That'd be lovely. We can put it out for people to listen to. And hopefully that won't happen again. But so In that programme last week, we had some interesting bits and bobs from the UN, Martin, which was the General Assembly was going on at the time. So where better to go now with some of the people who spoke after we were on air this time last week? And one of them is the very chap you mentioned, the Prime Minister of Malaysia.
Trade wars are wasteful. Now that the whole world has become a market for everyone, trade wars will stultify the potential for everyone to become rich. We are also seeing sanctions being applied to countries. We do not know under what laws sanctions are applied. It appears to be the privilege of the rich and the powerful. If we want to have sanctions, let us have a law to govern them. The fact is that when sanction is applied to a country, other countries get sanctioned as well. Malaysia and many others lost a big market when sanction is applied on Iran. I believe in capitalism, but capitalism has gone mad. They are already talking of making trillions of dollars. It is dangerous for a person or a company to have so much money. It can influence things. It can buy power. Hence, the need for antitrust laws. We see in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or the TPP, when the rich companies had given themselves the power to sue governments. The terms of the agreements were drawn up by them, and they are not all like Bill Gates, who spends some money on charity. Most are bent on exploiting the power money gives them.
Well, that is the 95-year-old Mahathir Mohamad, Prime Minister of Malaysia, Martin. What do you make of what he was saying there about sanctions? But is he saying that there is no real international regulations? Particularly looking at the case of Iran, the US sanctions on Iran, he's saying, well, actually, this means that the US is being so strict about these sanctions that even Malaysian companies can't sell anything to Iran now.
Well, and the US has no legal basis for what it's doing in international law. But they don't care about international law. And, of course, that ultimately leads to a situation where there's no rules and there's no rules. And that's warfare, isn't it, ultimately?
I thoroughly recommend listening to some of these speeches. Some of them are very good. And I think, actually, for me, the star of the show at the UN General Assembly this year has been Imran Khan from Pakistan. Again, another Muslim country. He here talks about the whole engagement in his main speech to the UN General Assembly this time last week, just after this show, from 9/11 to Kashmir. And he also talks about trees.
Come 9/11, Pakistan joined the United States in this war on terror. And now our government was supposed to, the reason why I opposed joining this war, because here we had indoctrinated them in jihad, meaning freedom struggle against foreign occupation. Now, because we had joined the US and the US had occupied Afghanistan, now we were supposed to tell them that no, this is not freedom struggle and jihad, it's terrorism. So that's why I tried to tell then government that, you know, stay neutral because you will have leverage over them. You will be able to control them, but if you join them, you become collaborators and they will attack you, which is what happened. They turned against us. We went through a nightmare. 70,000 people killed in a war we had nothing to do with. No Pakistani was involved in 9/11. Taliban were in Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda was in Afghanistan. What had we to do with it? 70,000 Pakistanis died. So when we came to power, we decided that we would dismantle what was left of these groups. And this decision was taken not just by us, but by all the political parties in Pakistan. Unfortunately, they didn't implement it. So we came to power, we decided to implement it, and we dismantled whatever was left of the groups. And I know that India keeps accusing us that there are these groups there. I would like the United Nations to send observers, see for themselves what we've done. No Pakistani government would have dared to do this because it would have created strife. But we decided that there would be no militant organizations in Pakistan. So I need to give you this background and to what I'm going to say later on. And secondly, we started mending fences. I invited the Afghan president. We developed a relationship with Afghanistan. We had problems with Iran. We mended fences there. And then India. Now, let me just give you a little background about my relationship with India. Because of cricket, and cricket being one of the, it's a passion in the subcontinent, I had great following in India. I have friends in India. And I loved going to India. So immediately, when my party came to power, the first thing we did was to immediately reach out to India. And I spoke to President Modi and I said, look, we have similar problems. Climate change, poverty. Let's get together. Let's resolve our differences through trade. Let's build a relationship on trust. Prime Minister Modi told me that, you know, there were terrorist attacks from Pakistan. I said, we have problems with you. There are terrorist attacks which we know are instigated from by India in Balochistan. We caught a spy, Kulbushan Yadav, who admitted what the sabotage going on in Karachi and Balochistan. So we said, look, let's leave that behind. Let's move forward. Our main priority should be our people. The highest number of poor people live in the Indian subcontinent. Unfortunately, didn't make any headways. Our foreign minister was supposed to meet on this in the UNGA last year. India cancelled it. We thought that it's their election coming up. It's a nationalist, ultra-nationalist party. It doesn't want to cozy up to Pakistan. So we thought, okay, we'll wait till the elections. Meanwhile, a 20-year-old Kashmiri boy, whose father said was radicalized by the security forces in Kashmir, blew himself up on an Indian convoy. Immediately, India blamed us. I spoke to the Indian public on television. I said, if you give us any iota of proof, we will immediately take action because we've clamped down on these groups. Rather than sending us any proofs, they sent their jets in, they bombed us. We retaliated. A jet, two of their planes were shot down, one pilot bailed out in Pakistan. We immediately returned the pilot, saying that, look, we do not want any escalation. Rather than taking that as a peace gesture, the entire campaign, almost the entire campaign of Mr. Modi in the election was how he had taught Pakistan a lesson that they had jets had killed 350 terrorists. Complete lie. They had just killed about 10 trees of ours, which was quite painful given that, you know, we are growing all these trees.
I mean, that's pretty much where that clip finishes, Martin. But I mean, he's basically saying that there's been all sorts of media lies about this problem that's started, the occupation, Indian occupation, military occupation of Kashmir with its 8 million people for the last, what is it now, nearly 3 months or 2.5 months?
Well, I mean, it's been going on a lot longer than that, obviously.
What they've done is they've completely changed. What they've done is they've turned it into basically a prison camp. No communication.
Oh, no, there's been an escalation, but the problem has been there from the beginning of the creation of both states in the 1940s, because they were promised in Kashmir that they would have a plebiscite.
So what are the Indian Air Force doing, bombing trees and saying, oh, we've killed a whole load of terrorists?
Well, I mean, what they're doing is, Modi basically used it as a means to try and rally his Hindutva base inside India. And he turned the whole, as Imran Khan pointed out, the whole election campaign came to be about, you know, chest beating about fighting with Pakistan.
So who's pulling Modi's strings?
Well, no, nobody. Modi is the leader of a very powerful country. and he's very much he's probably pro-American. He got a very good big welcome from Trump. Trump went to his meeting in Texas. Business groups in India are he keeps them happy because his Hindu nationalist politics keeps sort of more left-wing politics off the agenda. So he's got plenty of wealthy allies, although he is himself from a relatively humble background. But at the same time, ultimately, he's got a track record for potentially, the massacres in Gujarat when he was in charge of Gujarat. There's evidence to suggest that the attack on the Hindu pilgrims in the train wasn't an accident and it wasn't carried out by Muslims. So, and the research and analysis wing of the Indian Army are quite capable of carrying out terrorist attacks, false flag terrorist attacks. But then, of course, Imran Khan's being slightly economical with the truth, because the ISI in Pakistan was also implicated. In fact, General Gul, who was in charge of the ISI on 9/11, came out straight away and said, well, we know he did that, and it wasn't us, it was the American Secret Services who did that.
He's talking about the war on terror there, but let's go back to the beginning, sort of like a few years of that, and the Iraq war in 2003. Is this film just coming out at the moment called Official Secrets, and Keira Knightley and Catherine Gunn involved in that. Catherine Gunn being the real person, Keira Knightley is playing, but this is all about blowing the whistle at GCHQ, taking info to the London press, saying actually the Americans are trying to fix the vote in the Security Council, a vote which they actually failed to fix. So in a way, what Catherine's done, it may have been crucial in turning it from illegal into an illegal war.
Yes, of course, and it'll be interesting to see what the film does.
But well, let's have a listen to a clip from the film now, then, eh?
Catherine Gunn, what were you employed to do?
I translated signals intelligence, and I reported anything of interest to my clients.
You're a spy.
Did you get this email?
The Americans want us to help them get a UN resolution for war.
This proposed war is historically unpopular.
I work for the British people. I do not gather intelligence so that the government can lie to the British people.
Intelligence may be being manipulated to take this country to war.
I could get you a copy.
You're asking me to collude in a breach of the Official Secrets Act.
Someone has betrayed their government and their country.
If we do not go public, we would be conceding that no one can ever tell the people when their government is lying.
Your marriage will be interrogated.
My husband had absolutely nothing to do with this.
He's a Muslim.
I'm sorry?
You chose loyalty to your country over loyalty to your government, your marriage, and yourself. I think that speaks rather highly of you.
Catherine Theresa Gunn, you're charged with an offence of the Official Secrets Act.
Do you want to risk it all?
How do you plead?
Well, Official Secrets is set for release in UK cinemas on the 18th of October, Martin. Americans have already been watching it. It had a world premiere at the Sundance Film Festival in January this year. I'll put a little link up to the trailer on our show page. Not sure quite when it's going to be in Bristol, but in the next couple of weeks. But a very important event, really.
Yes, and can I just mention a plug, the Stop the War meeting on the Don't Have a War with Iran on the People's Republic of South Cross next Tuesday. I just thought I'd get that in because I've...
next Tuesday evening, yeah, because this is about stopping the next one.
Yeah, stopping the next one. Yeah, I mean, the fact is that we were all mobilised and motivated to try and stop that war, and people then got disappointed that we didn't succeed. But of course, ultimately, these things have to be consistent over a very long period if you're going to change
society.
So
who was Catherine Gunn, and what did she do?
Well, she was a translator. I think she's a Chinese translator at GCHQ in Cheltenham. And she realised that they were basically, against all of the rules, Britain was bugging the delegations to the UN to discuss what was going to happen about threats to Iraq. And she grassed it up, basically,
And, well, she took a leak to The Guardian, I think, and it may have been other newspapers as well, but it isn't always guaranteed, is it, that if you take a leak to one of these national newspapers that they'll actually do anything. I mean, we had the whole business of the Jimmy Savile scandal. Even after he was dead, the London newspapers just simply didn't want to know.
Well, obviously, today we've been hearing about the Metropolitan Police being given a beating because of the investigation into VIP paedophilia, and I still think that there was a load of protection going on there. Ultimately, whistleblowers are very brave people. Look at what's happening to Julian Assange.
One of the things about what you're saying, okay, yes, we could talk about Assange too, but about Carl Beach and other people who apparently have now been prosecuted for going to the police and telling them about child sexual abuse. Now, I would have thought that it's the police's job to check the veracity of those statements rather than now to be prosecuting individuals who've gone to the police with evidence.
18 years seems an extraordinary for somebody who everybody admitted that he had been sexually abused, and of course the jury were directed not to listen to the fact that they were told that he downloaded child pornography, but of course they should also have been told that's quite a normal thing for people who've been sexually abused to do. So it didn't make them an unreliable witness at all. Now, there's a whole load of things that need to be said about this, and we probably haven't got time to go into that particular. But I think it's a really, obviously, people who do things like Catherine Gunn are heroines and heroes. Of course they are. And they need to be supported. And of course, often they are not, and they pay the price. Chelsea Manning is rotting in prison, so is, and she was the whistleblower. And she's still rotting in prison with no basis whatsoever. What happened to habeas corpus? Magna Carta.
Well, good question. Maybe someone got to the state prosecutor, Martin, eh?
Well, yes. I mean, it is all about rule of law in the end. As Posimato was the head of the Italian Supreme Court, and he wrote a book in 2012 about how NATO had been murdering and massacring all over Western Europe since 1950.
Yes, thanks. You mentioned that in Don't Take and Ram public meeting. That's next Tuesday, 8th of October at 7 p.m. at PRSC 14 Hillgrove Street. I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But it's October, which is Black History Month. I thought we'd have something which really goes to the roots of some of the cultural changes that have happened due to colonialism. And who better to ask than the Sun? I mean, he really is a super brain, this guy. So I guess he's, what, Super Brain 3 or Super Brain 4. His name's Anton Chaitkin, and his father, Jacob Chaitkin, was the lawyer and strategist for the American Jewish Boycott Committee of Nazi Germany. And here, have a listen to what he has to say about this whole theory of the black legend, the attempt to turn the clock back to pre-colonial days.
You were talking about the American system, you know, but at the same time, I was kind of wondering, you know, sort of about what's called a black legend.
Yes.
And Lyndon LaRouche's method of economics to go over and prove that the black legend wasn't actually, you know, says as it was stated. Do you have any update on that right there as to how that correlates?
Yes. Say something on that. Black legend means, historically, it refers to the theory that the white Christian Spaniards, Catholic Spaniards, came to what is now Latin America and persecuted the Indians, dominated them, massacred them, claimed to be spreading the Christian religion when they were only trying to rip them off, and got rid of this wonderful indigenous Indian culture, which now is trying to fight its way back to freedom. That's the black legend. Now, the originators of this black legend are the British. They're, in a certain sense, it's a mirror image of exactly what they did everywhere they went. They massacred the natives. They tried to impose something on the natives. It wasn't ever Christianity. So there's another correlative, because in the black legend, they don't say that the Spaniards were really interested in spreading Christianity. They sort of leave that in a vague way. It's all slavery, destitution, and so forth. the heart of this, this is a very important thing. It's not a minor point, because this is something that people are terrified to discuss. Partly because there's a big anti-Catholic rap in the black community as well as the white community, right? The Masons spread this stuff. It goes right through the Masons. It comes from England. It goes through other channels. It goes through the Protestant church also. You are told when you go to school that you do not have the right, and you're told this by the media as well, that you don't have the right to compare one culture with another and say that one culture is better than another one. That's racist. Now that's just an insane way of thinking. The way this applies to the black legend is to say that the Christian Spaniards who came into Latin America and intermarried with the Indians, forming a new so-called race of people. I don't go for this race thing. There's only one race of humans. Forming a new color or a new color scheme or whatever it is, right? that they got rid of this wonderful native culture. Well, there was in the Americas, in some parts of the Americas, at certain times, a relatively advanced culture. There were the Olmecs who had a calendar. There were other people who made accomplishments, none of which would be approved today by the British or by the environmentalists. They studied astronomy rather than astrology and so forth. They built cities. In some places, they fell to great depths of degradation. For example, the Plains Indians. If you would want your children to live in the degradation of the Plains Indians, forget about the white man's role in anything to do with them. Who did not have settled agriculture, but chased buffaloes off cliffs. Who lived in a state of warfare. Not all Indians did, but some of them did, up there. Much worse than the Plains Indians, the Aztecs in Mexico, who practiced satanic, not just rituals, but sadistic satanic acts, and were the scourge of neighboring peoples, including peoples that had a higher culture and had invented technologies and cities which the Aztecs took over and did not invent themselves, and are given credit by a bunch of anthropologists who hate all dark-skinned people anyway. Now, if you were not to say that the European culture, European Christian culture, that came into Mexico was better than the Aztecs, that brought in churches, that brought in music. You ever hear a mass written by a Mexican composer in the 1700s? You should, they're beautiful. If you ever see some of the churches they built, they're beautiful. Do you know that Mexico outlawed slavery? Spanish Mexico, not Aztec Mexico. Aztec Mexico is based on slavery. Spanish Mexico, Christian Mexico, Catholic Mexico outlawed slavery. Right?
What year?
What's that?
What year? When?
As soon as they had an independent country. 1811. So, now, are we not able to compare the Christian culture to the Aztec? I think we should. How can you prove that that's the right thing to do? That's moral and not racist. Let's compare make a few other cultural comparisons, which are your politically correct school teacher or media says you're not allowed to. Let's compare the culture of the United States of 1994 to the culture of the United States in 1963. Yes. We're a lot worse than we were. We don't know as much. You're not as moral. In almost every sense of the word. Life is cheaper. We don't believe in preserving human life. We have mass abortions. We have mass pornography. We have mass drugs. We have mass homosexuality. We believe in killing grandma, and half the population agrees in this now, right? euthanasia. We don't know as much. We don't know as much science, foreign languages, and on, right? So the culture has declined. I think we can reverse that. But you've got to be able to compare what we were in the era of the Kennedy space program and the Martin Luther King civil rights movement, which uplifted our country and was an example from past times also. We had things similar to that. So our culture is worse today than it was in 63. Let's take Germany. Compare Germany 1943 to Germany 1798. Aren't you allowed to make that comparison between one culture and the other? It'd be pretty stupid if you couldn't say that the culture of Hitler was worse than the culture of Beethoven. Same country, but different culture, right? Can you make a comparison and say one culture is more moral, is superior to another? Are you better? Or else you've lost your whole power of judgment. What, are you insane? So the Black Legend is based on these British characters like Aldous Huxley and also some people in the Catholic Church, like certain Jesuits and so forth, who have this idea of cultural relativism and ethics, medical ethics, like Georgetown University, where human life is cheap. Right? Yes. Well, the British Empire is the chief source of this philosophy in our time. Absolutely. And of this war against the Christian faith, which they call a war against the Catholic Church.
Well, that's Anton Chaitkin with some pretty controversial ideas about the Aztecs, Martin about the conquistadors. I don't think he's saying the conquistadors were wonderful guys, but he's saying that the opposite isn't true either.
Well, in actual fact, I would agree with that. It's very, very complicated, isn't it? History isn't simple. There aren't superior cultures and inferior cultures. And if you look at the development of the state in Latin America before contact in 1492, the state was a pretty rapacious creature, just as it had been in Mesopotamia and Egypt some 2,000 years earlier as the basis of Western civilization.
One of the things he's doing there is he's really having a go at the Brits. He's saying a lot of these problems have come from the culture that's come with the British Empire.
Let's talk about the Black Legend. The Black Legend was evolved by propagandists in England like Sir Walter Raleigh and others, and they were very keen. We were brought up with it. When we watch Errol Flynn films from the 1950s, the Spaniards were always the baddies, and that's because in that era England and Spain were at war. You remember the Spanish Armada and all the rest of it, and that of course is where the Black Legend comes from. And of course, in actual fact, the British Empire was no better in many ways than the Spanish Empire. So the idea that the Spanish were uniquely terrible and horrible and the British were good and kind is obviously rubbish. The idea of the Aztecs were just good and kind is also rubbish. But of course, the real thing is that smaller societies in North America were relatively peaceful compared to state-based societies, whether Spanish, English or Aztec.
Controversial views, I think, is totally interesting, though. Anyway, so we'll finish, I think, tonight, Martin, with this look at Epstein and the link to Silicon Valley, exposed by Whitney Webb, as she's talking to Jason Burmes here.
It was actually acknowledged in Israel in 2012 that there was this new effort among Israeli intelligence agencies, you know, basically the Mossad and military intelligence, to outsource a lot of activities that used to be done in-house. And the way they decided to do this was to create private companies. And they would basically take the people in these intelligence agencies that were in charge of a particular project, and they would say, make your startup or make your private company. And continue the project that way. And we know from Israeli media reports that Black Cube is one of these companies, that it was spun out of the Mossad basically to be a privatized Mossad, which is why it's no secret that, you know, the chairman of their board was Meir Dagan, the longtime head of Mossad until his death in 2016, was the head of Black Cube. And a lot of it's the people that work for it are ex-Israeli military intelligence or, you know, ex-Mossad, basically. They conduct several different types of activities. They do things on behalf of people like Harvey Weinstein. They do things on behalf of corporations like corporate espionage. But they also have a political section. We know, for example, that they were trying to sabotage the Iran nuclear deal by trying to get information on the sexual activities and finances of the main people in the U.S. That were negotiating The Iran nuclear deal for the Obama administration on that side.
It's not always right. Underage girls. It's, hey, they're using drugs. These are their sexual proclivities. Mm-hmm. Perhaps they're cheating.
Anything that can be used as blackmail is used as blackmail. You know, the pedophile sex blackmail, that's a very specific type of blackmail, but the net is much wider than that. I'm glad you brought up Epstein and Silicon Valley for a second, because Epstein, just a year before his recent arrest and death or whatever, basically said, I have all this damaging information on people in Silicon Valley, including, as you said, their drug use and their sexual, you know, fantasies and tendencies and things like that. So it's worth considering, you know, did he use that to advance, for example, the ambitions of Carbon 911 or, you know, Israeli military intelligence interests in Silicon Valley? There's actually this guy who is a former executive producer for CBS News who's been reporting on some aspects of the Epstein-Israeli intelligence connection. And he said that he was able to confirm independently with a couple sources that Epstein was connected to Israeli military intelligence directly. I think that personally had to do with the Silicon Valley aspects, based on what we know about his involvement with Carbine 911 and some other things, for example, and his, you know, claim to have all this leverage over Silicon Valley people specifically. And in the last years of his life, he was trying to rebrand. We know this for a fact. He was trying to rebrand as a tech investor and get involved in a lot of high tech type stuff.
Whitney Webb there, Martin. Interesting angle. Final story, though. Neo-Nazi terrorist cell on trial over alleged Berlin attack plot. 8 members of Revolution Chemnitz accused of planning armed assaults on immigrants from Germany, this is.
Well, that's the first I've heard of it, but it wouldn't surprise me.
What's that about, do you think?
Well, we know that there's a far right in Germany, as there has been for many years, and some of them are not very nice people. And, of course, they've got links to the intelligence services, the BND, the Western Intelligence Service, the External Intelligence Service.
Okay, time to sign off now for all the US-owned Comcast News at 8. Thanks to our guests in the first hour. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page, and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
National news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.